The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but the Christians who claim to believe in God do not show enough compassion, especially where the subject of same-sex attraction is concerned. Well, we have a special guest today who believes that challenge and compassion need not be mutually exclusive words, that people can be challenged in their thinking without compassion needing to be a casualty. It's my pleasure to introduce Debbie Thurman. Debbie is a Christian journalist, award-winning columnist, and unabashed apologist for the Christian faith. She's the author of 7 nonfiction books. Her most recent book, Post-Gay, Post-Christian, with a question mark in the title, takes on the subject of same-sex attraction with courage and insight. She's written scores of articles and commentaries, published in a variety of newspapers and magazines over her 35-year writing career. She's been a church teacher and ministry leader for more than 25 years. She serves in her church's women's ministry and previously was a small group leader in Freedom Ministry, a Christ-centered recovery ministry. Debbie and her husband Ross have been married for 30 years. They reside in Central Virginia and have 2 married daughters. Together, they served a total of 30 years in the United States Marine Corps as public affairs officers, and they're founders of Post One Ministries, an outreach of encouragement to married couples and families. Debbie, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you, too. Now, your own Christian testimony is fascinating, so why don't we start with that, and then we'll kind of get into your book and other things. But you have an absolutely fascinating background.
Well, I appreciate that you think so. I think that I love that God loves me. I don't know how fascinating he finds me compared to other people, but I know I'm special to him. And I, of course, I'm talking to you and to your audience in what would be my second home, the San Diego area. We lived in San Diego County, North County, actually, for over 17 years.
Oh, really? Now, which part of North County?
Vista.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah, so have a lot of friends.
So you'll be happy to know they're still working on extending Highway 15. I'm sure they were doing that when you were there, and I'm sure they were doing that when the Dead Sea was still alive.
Probably. Anyway, yeah, we joke about our traffic jams here that we have in our little one-horse town. But, yeah, this is where I grew up. Central Virginia, near Lynchburg, is where I was born and raised and grew up. And I'm one of 4 children. Actually, 2 of my brothers are still living. One passed away about 10 years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
We had a lot of challenges growing up. Now, my parents got married quite young. My mom was only 16. My dad was 19. They both had high school educations, both very bright. My dad was actually a very talented carpenter and had his own contracting business and was doing quite well. We were just a normal middle-class family growing up in rural Central Virginia. And unfortunately, though, my dad had some demons that we didn't know about, and that pressures in his work and pressures in life seemed to bring to the forefront, and he chose to begin drinking, and that became something I did very heavily, and it had a very, very detrimental impact on our family. He could not seem to stop doing that. Actually, he was in and out of mental hospitals for a number of years, and so we had a very tough upbringing. My mom was helping him in his business, and she was a homemaker and very active in our church, but she ended up having to go back to school, which was very hard on her, and She did get a college degree. She got a master's degree, and she was a teacher and spent almost 30 years teaching. And she supported us, and we had the help of our extended family, which is something that my own children haven't had as much of the benefit of. Coming back here, they're around my family more, but when we were in California, we did not have any of our family anywhere around. And I think that in some ways made my struggle, well, in some ways it may have made it easier, in some ways it made it much more difficult for me. My church and other friends became my family, but I, apparently, the apple didn't fall too far from the tree. Mental illness seems to have run in my family for generations, actually, I found out, on both sides. And I had a very severe struggle with depression, major depressive disorder, and I cycled in and out of depression for about 10 years. And that whole battle really played out in San Diego. I saw a psychiatrist back there. He was a very compassionate doctor, helped me a tremendous amount, but I had a lot of support. My husband was extremely supportive. My church was supportive. We really kind of kept that struggle very, you know, under wraps for the most part. Only a few close friends really knew what I was dealing with. A lot of people never knew, and they were kind of shocked when they found out later that I had gone through the struggle. But, you know, I was a very sensitive child growing up, and when I was 8, I had the misfortune of being molested by an older cousin. That didn't help any. So I grew up...
This is a male or female cousin?
A male cousin. And I grew up just feeling... you know, guilt, shame over that.
Isn't that something? Children are the ones that feel the guilt when they get molested, because in their minds, adults can do no wrong. And it throws their world topsy-turvy, so they're thinking there must have been something I did.
Yeah, I actually thought that I was responsible for it. But anyway, I was very, you know, involved in school. I was involved both in academics and in athletics. And, of course, that became really a saving grace for both my brothers and me. We really, sports were a real positive outlet for us. And, you know, I did fairly well in school, went on to college. And when I got to college is when it really, the chinks in my armor began to, you know, sort of reveal themselves, at least to me. Because of a lot of complex factors, there is no one-size-fits-all description of a person who at some point in their life deals with same-sex attraction, but it was something that I was aware of at a fairly early age. And of course, it was my deep dark secret. I couldn't share that with anybody. And when I got to college, I was at an all women's college, and of course, this was during the 70s, early to mid-70s. And,
right, this is, you know, which is the heel of what we call the 60s, really, where these sexual revolutions are going on in our country.
I'm a product of the sexual revolution. So, yeah, I mean, everything was quite a bit looser than I would than I would certainly want it to be for my own children. I think we've only spiraled down, but somehow I think we found some sanity along the way. But I began to, you know, really, really struggle with my feelings. And it came to a head with a person, an older woman that I, you know, really had a very strong attraction to. And I, of course, had been dating seriously another young man that I went to high school with. And he
now, do you mind me asking, if any of these questions are too personal, just tell me, but I'm assuming that when you say you were finding yourself attracted to this woman, but you were dating, that you were actually attracted to men and women both?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I was the proverbial pigtail tomboy, little country girl growing up, because I had all brothers. I was comfortable with part of my feminine side, but just not fully comfortable, and had this other side that was there. You know, I kept trying to push it back and deny that it was there. But as I grew older, of course, it began to really come more to the forefront, and I had to deal with it. I had no choice. It's like burying a worm. You can't do it. So anyway, I went off with my mother to my mother, who was teaching in the county school system, had been approved to go overseas and teach in the DOD system. And I had graduated from college and had not succeeded in finding a job yet, so I thought I would just take some time off, go over and travel and maybe try to work a little bit. And I did. I ended up going over to Europe, to Germany and Austria for about 8 months, and I lived for half of that time with an Austrian family, and it was a very good experience. I'm glad I did it. I was an au pair to their four children, and I got to travel some with them, and I really, really enjoyed it. I got to see, you know, a number of sites in Europe, and that was a great experience. But, and of course, I, in the meantime, had also in the back of my mind been thinking about the military. I guess I'm one of those people who, you know, thought that I would find myself there, and so that was kind of in the back of my mind. And when I came back, I decided to go take the officer qualification test for the Marines, and my uncle had been a career officer, and he had talked to me, and, you know, I thought that sounded like something that maybe I should do. So I did, and I went in to that very interesting phase of life, which was, again, a time of social experimentation by the Marine Corps, because my officer candidates class was the first class to have women go through combat arms training, even though we could not hold billets.
Wow, you were really breaking some ground then, weren't you?
We were big time breaking ground. In fact, one of my classmates just left within, I guess, the last year or so. She was the commanding general of Marine Corps Recruit Depot right there in San Diego, the first woman to ever command, Angie Salinas. So, yeah, she broke out and really was the star from our class, but there are some 19 of us that went through that class, and so I that is how I ended up meeting my first husband, and that turned out to be a dreadful mistake for both of us. Neither one of us was prepared for marriage, and I had so many issues I had to work through that marriage failed very rapidly. And
rapidly would be how long?
Within 2 years.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
At the 3-year mark, we were divorced. So, and then of course I consequently found myself sort of spiraling down into depression, because it had been a very, very tough that happened back here on the East Coast at Camp Lejeune, but it was just a very emotionally difficult time for me, and I made some dreadful mistakes. I just made some horrible judgments, and you know, those really were haunting me, and that was a catalyst that sent me spiraling into depression. And then we came back to San Diego when of course, I had met Russ, and subsequently we had fallen in love and gotten married, and we actually married in San Marcos, as a matter of fact. And I went to work for a company in San Diego, and, you know, things seemed to be going okay, but about a year into my employment there, everything just fell apart. I had a total breakdown.
And what would you say was the major catalyst for that?
Just memories and thoughts, my own guilt.
Like memories of the molestation kind of coming back to you?
Not really memories of that. I had forgiven, you know, him, and actually he had asked me a few years ago for forgiveness too, so which very rarely ever happens in situations like
that.
But it was just more my failure in my first marriage, the mistakes that I had made. I was supposed to know better. I was a Christian. I was raised, you know, in the church, and, you know, I was a good Baptist girl. I knew how to beat myself up pretty good.
Okay, Debbie, hold with me over the break, if you will.
Sure.
My guest is Debbie Thurman, author of the book Gay Post-Christian. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is Lori K. Lewis, a frequent co-host on The Bob Siegel Show, Talk Radio 1170 on KCBQ. If you have questions or comments during this radio broadcast, please call Bob at this toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. Again, the number is 1-888-344-1170. We'd like to hear what you have to say. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. I'm here with Debbie Thurman, author of the book Post Gay, Post Christian. So, Debbie, you were telling us your second marriage had begun. Russ, the man you're still married to, went well for about a year, and then a lot of depressing feelings and memories from your past started to haunt you.
Yes, just, I was consumed with guilt and just terrible feelings of failure and worthlessness, and I spiraled very rapidly into serious depression, and didn't know what to do at first. I mean, I talked to my doctor. I was afraid of taking medication because I had seen my dad on medication. I had seen other relatives, and I thought, no, I don't want that. I'll turn into a robot. I can't handle that. Please, God, there got to be another way. But my depression was so severe that it came to the point where I had no choice, and I did. I trusted my doctor, fortunately, and he was very, very compassionate. He knew what he was doing, and that was when I finally got to that point, which was, about 5 years into my struggle, I began to turn things around. And it took two different medications to finally get me to the point where I could finish working through some of the things I had to work through, or so I thought. What I wasn't working through, what nobody still knew, was this other struggle, which had sort of taken a back seat when I was really dealing with depression.
I just can't even imagine the alienation and loneliness to have to keep a secret like that.
Well, it is among one of the worst kinds of pain, I think, emotionally, that a person can experience. I really do have a great deal of compassion for anybody who's struggling and just doesn't know what to do.
Well, yeah, because if you open up with somebody who's open to that lifestyle, then you're going down a path you don't want to go. Yeah. If you open up to somebody who's not open with it, you run the risk of being judged and condemned. So it's kind of a lose-lose.
That's so true. And it's by the grace of God that I didn't go down a path any farther than I did. I went far enough and did enough damage. And after having to deal with the feelings of guilt and failure from my divorce and all of that, I got to a point where I became fully rebellious. This was at about the 10-year mark in our marriage, and this is after I had really come through my depression, and I felt like, okay, that's behind me now. But all of a sudden, the other struggle came up and hit me in the face full force. And this time, I was really in the clutches of of the enemy. Satan did a number on me, and I became.
Yeah, he's pretty good about broadsiding us from out of nowhere, isn't he?
Yes, he is, and I should have been better prepared, of course, but I wasn't, and I became involved in several relationships, and not only was that having a detrimental impact on me and potentially on my marriage when it all came out, but on those people as well. So now I have another whole series of things that I have to deal with, that I, have to work through the guilt.
Just what you needed, more guilt.
Yes, like I said, I was a professional at heaping guilt on myself. I knew how to do that very well.
Well, so, and sometimes as Christians, we can shroud those things with spirituality because we're surrounded by people who, the Bible does teach that we're all sinners. But that doesn't mean that God wants us to beat up on ourselves with unwarranted guilt either. But sometimes that guilt finds a happy home behind words like sin, unfortunately.
Well, we don't know how to accept God's grace.
Exactly.
It's too good to believe.
It is. It sounds too good to be true.
Been raised in faith.
Yeah, I think for all the skepticism people have, that's usually the bottom line with a lot of it. It does sound too good to be true.
Yeah. It can't be this simple, God. It can't be. No, I have to work my way through this.
Or we feel like he could forgive somebody else, but what I did was so heinous, there's no way he could forgive me.
Yeah. Hard,
yeah.
Well, I haven't already come through the depression battle, which had become at one point an actual life and death struggle. I really did not want to live. And while I didn't have a plan for actively taking my life, and that when I credit my faith for at least giving me that little pinpoint of hope that allowed me not to do that, it was pretty bad. And when my husband found out what was going on, and I think I willingly allowed that to happen because I was desperate. I think it had to happen.
Did you tell him, or did you allow him to find out in some disgrace?
I did.
You just put all the cards on the table.
He sort of you know, began figuring things out, and I filled in the blanks. Mm-hmm. So it was horrible. It was the absolute, you know, worst. I don't know. I can't say how long. I don't remember how many months it was when we were in the dire struggle just for a marriage. It was so close to being completely over. And by that,
but now
time,
he obviously did not
children.
He did not reject you though. So
it took every ounce of strength and much prayer for him to be able to just go back to square one with me.
Sure. Sure.
And walk with me that very difficult road back to redemption. It was difficult. The betrayal that I had brought to him, of course, was something that I had to live with and I had to work through. And so it took a lot of prayer, a lot of tears. I just remember one night we got up in the middle of the night. We couldn't sleep. It was horrible. We went downstairs in our living room and we knelt at an ottoman and we just said, "This is our altar. And we don't know what else to do." But weeping, we just gave it all to God and said, "God, you have got to take this. We can't do this. You've got to do this." And that was the beginning. That was the beginning. There was still much work to do. And I became, I started looking for a counselor. And fortunately, I was referred to a very good counselor. I had to go all the way up to Redlands. But I did that for a year and met every week for a year.
Well, it's to your credit that you stayed with that. Most married couples would have just given up at this point, I think.
He did. He was with me, you know, for part of that, and then part of it was just work that I had to do myself. But he supported me. He supported me through that, and, I credit that counselor with saving our marriage, certainly. God really saved it, but she was an agent, an instrument that he used and worked through, and she was wonderful. A wonderful godsend. So, you know, that that is basically, and then we just have stayed the course. We just simply said, we will work through this. We will stay together. Divorce is not an option. It is not an option. And in my case, I know a lot of people are wondering, okay, so what happened to you? So your marriage, you turned it around, you and your husband reconciled, but, you know, what happened to your feelings of same-sex attraction and all of that? Well, I would have to say that, you know, God having done the miracle in my life once with bringing me through depression and having worked through so many different issues that really were contributing factors in many ways, he really did complete the miracle and bring me full circle.
So you would say that the attraction to other women went away completely?
Basically, there are memories. You'll never be able
to
get rid of
memories. Once something goes in your mind, you're never going to get it out completely.
Exactly. And I know, I really don't have those feelings of attraction. I know, however, I am not naive, and I know that every one of us is fully capable of stumbling under the right circumstances, and I can never, you know, say that there may not be another temptation.
Sure. Well, any human being could be tempted by anything at any time,
exactly.
And we're naive to think otherwise. Okay, Debbie, hold with me over the break. My guest is Debbie Thurman, author of the book Post-Gay, Post-Christian. We'll be right back. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. My guest is Debbie Thurman, fascinating guest, author of the book Post Gay, Post Christian. Debbie, welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
Now, Debbie, when you say that God actually healed you of same-sex attraction, in some ways I think there's a challenge out here for for different people, because I know some people are going to listen to that and say, well, no, wait a minute. If you're born gay, you're born gay, and you can't do anything about that. But I know that on the other hand, a lot of times Christians want to rush over like puppy dogs and lay hands on people and say, well, if you just trust God, you can instantly be healed. This took many years of counseling on your part. But I also know that I've talked to people who've dealt with this issue, and they would, I think it's wonderful if in your case those feelings have completely gone away. But some people would say the feelings have not completely gone away, but that doesn't mean that they haven't turned from it. I did a radio interview with Alan Chambers from Exodus Ministry. He said something that I've never forgotten over the air. He said, and I want to get your response to this. He said, the opposite of homosexuality is not heterosexuality, but holiness. Mm-hmm. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I know Alan well, and I know that he said that a number of times. And, you know, in truth, every one of us, as you said before you went to the break, has something that we struggle with. We come into this world inheriting it's our fallen sin nature. And I really think that homosexuality should not be looked at any differently than any other struggle that we have.
And I think the church has done a great disservice for many years.
Yeah.
I do think they're getting better these days, but if you go back to the early 70s when gay people were first coming out of the closet, it was kind of treated in a class by itself. And I think that if people struggling with same-sex attraction had seen the church as a sanctuary where they could confess that like anybody could confess any other sin, we might not be going through a lot of the rifts we're going through in our culture right now.
Oh, yes. The church has us a lot to overcome, unfortunately, and that's one of my big burdens, is to see that happen. I pray for that all the time, and I try to do what I can to get that message out there. But as far as what Alan was saying, you know, what he's saying is that you cannot take the spiritual element out of this. I mean, you have a lot of people who want to say, well, this is a mental health issue. This is, you know, therefore we're going to listen to what the psychologists have to say. We're going to listen to the research. We want to know what science has to say about this. Well, that's all well and good. But, you know, I want to know first what God has to say about it. And anybody who is going to be overcoming anything that they don't want, and no one starts out wanting these feelings, and believe me, they're not chosen. But anyone who's going to be overcoming has got to allow, you know, that transformation by the renewal of their mind, as Paul talked about in Romans 12. We are to seek holiness. We all are to seek holiness first. Many are separated from God, but there are many prodigals out there, and I really have a heart for the prodigals. I was a prodigal, obviously, from listening to my story. You can see that. And God loved me. He never abandoned me. He didn't forget about me. And I did have to get to my lowest point before coming to my senses. And it literally scared the devil out of me. And I thought, what have I done? And God did not make me for this. I don't want this. Why am I doing this? Again, that's Romans 7. You know, Paul talking about the wretched man that I am who will save me from the body of this death. Christ, obviously. And yes, we are to seek him and to seek to be like him, and to be like him is to be holy. So I understand what Alan means when he says that.
Now, it's interesting when you mentioned, you said nobody chooses this, and I agree, but I know some will listen and say, okay, well, then if you didn't choose it, you were born that way, like there's nothing in between. Isn't it true that different factors, and nobody's claiming there's any one cause for anything, but couldn't different factors influence us in our lives? And especially if they happen to us when we're little children, we may not even remember what they all are. But a person could say, I've had these feelings my whole life. They could be telling the truth. And it doesn't necessarily translate into something genetic or that they were born that way, does it?
No, not necessarily. And you know, I'll be the first to say, well, okay, great, if someone conclusively proves that there is, you know, a prenatal or, you know, a hormonal or a genetic connection. I mean, we can look at many things that we struggle with in life and see that I know that I had a genetic predisposition to depression.
Well, and they claim now that some have a predisposition genetically to alcohol, but we wouldn't encourage that person to drink.
No,
so we
got to
be consistent with these viewpoints.
Right, of course not. And God would not, I just can't believe that a loving God would create us with something that he did not have the power to heal us from. Again, this is a broken, fallen world. There are many things that we're going to struggle with. That's just the way it is. That's the story until Christ returns. But there's an answer, and there is hope. And to take hope out of the equation is to be cruel, I think.
Well, and even if it seems like even if they someday prove, and it hasn't been proven, but if they ever did prove that there was a genetic component to homosexuality, wouldn't that just prove that there are two kinds? Because they've already documented for many years many cases where there were explainable reasons that caused it. So I would think that if somebody's saying, I'm struggling with this, and okay, maybe it is genetic, but maybe it's psychological, I think we'd want to say, well, let's at least first explore the psychological path. And then if that doesn't work out, you know, why close the door on that?
Well, there's a lot of validity to looking at the psychological path, but we also have to realize that this is a highly complex topic, and it's not, of course, obviously the same for everyone, and you cannot, if you look in, for all the common denominators, you will find some common denominators for some or maybe most people, but then you'll find some that completely go into a different category.
Yeah, it's never a one-size-fits-all in life.
Right, right. And particularly with women, a lot of the research has been done focusing on men. Particularly with women, women have been shown to be, you know, much more fluid in their, you know, sexual identity. And there, you know, there are people out there who say, well, you know, I chose this.
Yeah, I found that in the many years of counseling as a pastor, when I would talk with men struggling with this, they would say, I've always been attracted to men. Only men, never women. I can't remember a time. With women, it was very different. They would, at least in the cases where I was counseling, they'd always say, no, I've been attracted to both, or I was attracted to men first, or then I got abused by a man. And like you said, much more fluid. So it is a completely different study, each gender.
It is. And, you know, we need, I just think that so many people, especially people in the church, they feel like, well, okay, this is out of my I'm out of my depth when I look at this subject. What do I do? It's very interesting. I read a piece this morning, a commentary that was written, and it pointed to. Actually, I'm sorry. This was earlier this week. It was one of Chuck Colson's Breakpoint commentaries, and he was talking about something called the spiral of silence, and I guess it was that phrase was coined by a German sociologist, and basically it says out of a desire to avoid reprisal or isolation, people go along with what they think is a popular opinion, even if they may object to that personally, because, you know, they don't want to.
Right. Okay, Debbie Thurman, author of the book Post-Gay, Post-Christian. We will be right back. Website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. I'm here with Debbie Thurman. Debbie, before we went to the break, you were talking about Chuck Colson and the spiraling. Why don't you continue with that?
Yeah, basically, I kind of left off in the middle of a thought there. But basically, where I come from, we call that go along to get along. But it's just, you know, really, there are a great deal of many people, and if you want to look just for a minute at the political side of this, which is the very contentious side, of course, we have at least 31 states that have voted for one man, one woman, you know, constitutional amendments for marriage. And so that demonstrates, and many of those have passed by very large margins, so that demonstrates that there is a strong opinion wherever it has been voted on. Of course, California is one of the biggest battleground states, and yours isn't resolved yet. It's
well, and then the people vote one way, and then the judge overturns it, and then... But it's funny, then years later you hear the historical revision, like in Massachusetts, I hear gay activists say, oh, the people decided. Well, people right. didn't decide that. Right. A judge decided that.
Oh, yeah, no. So, in other words, what I'm saying is, and what this spiral of silence thing is supposedly about is that people really do have opinions and they have feelings, but they have now been so conditioned by the culture to keep them to themselves or not express them, or by their silence, you know, appear to be giving consent to the demands, you know, of gay rights.
Yeah, you know, along those lines, on page 128 of your book, you write, gay rights activists count on their ability to convince a great many unsuspecting people that they have truth and justice cornered through manipulative tactics that give them the appearance of being victimized at every turn, despite the glowing gains in gay rights. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, just take the phrase gay rights for a minute. You know, that the term rights implies that something is being withheld, that something is being denied, you know, something that we deserve as gay people is being withheld from us. And of course, right now, the big thing is marriage, the right to marry. And all the, you know, everything that goes with that, all the benefits that go with it. And of course, I do see and I believe and I observe and I've spent years doing research on this, actually, that there has been a very well-orchestrated public relations movement, and it's been, you know, sort of out of necessity from their viewpoint, because on the one hand, there is a great deal of compassion that's merited, and we should be willing to give that, but that is the kind of compassion that says, we love you, we don't care that you're struggling, come into our fold, let us love you, this is what the church should be saying.
Right, but that's not the same as saying we affirm everything.
No,
we've got to compartmentalize the compassion with the affirmation.
There is truth and grace. They have to live in the same, you know, in the same body.
And well put.
That's the way the body of Christ has to be. That's the way we are to be. And we can't be afraid. That's what, you know, the spiral of silence is because people are afraid of the truth. And unfortunately, a great many people today are really biblically illiterate, and they may not be too sure what the truth is. And again, if you feed people half-truths long enough, you know, they're going to say, well, that sounds okay. I don't see what's wrong with that. Well, God has something to say about that, and it's in His Word, and He gave it to us, and it's not muddled, it's not confused. It's there, and all we have to do is go read it.
Now, Debbie, you were mentioning earlier that Christians find themselves out of their league or out of their depth with this, as you put it. I wish Christians would come to the conclusion that things are out of their league a little more often, because I think Christians are always giving
good
unsolicited
point.
Advice. I think the correct Christian response, if they meet somebody struggling with this, is to love them and without compromising, be their friends, be compassionate. We don't have to figure everything out. There may be some interesting reasons psychologically why these things happen. That's irrelevant. And it's not just on this issue. Christians somehow feel that they've got to always offer unsolicited advice, and I think they could find it very liberating themselves to say, hey, I don't have to fix everybody. I can just be there for them.
Yes, and I can trust God instead of, you know, feeling like I have to have a solution.
Right.
No, you're absolutely right. It's okay for us to, you know, just to say, look, I really don't understand. I don't have the answer. I don't have the answer to a lot of things, and I'm not going to know a whole lot until I'm standing face to face with Christ one day. But I do know that He loves me, and He loves you, and He's asked me to love you. And, you know,
and I'm not sure God intends for us to know much more than that anyway.
He just says, look, I prepared a table for you in the presence of your enemies.
Yeah. So it seems like I've seen some extremes with the church. Again, if we go back to the early 70s, like we were saying earlier, that I think Christians were putting homosexuals in a class of their own as if their sin is somehow worse than anybody else's. On the other hand, these days I see some churches swinging to the point where they're feeling so guilted into portraying themselves as tolerant that there's actual compromise. I noticed in chapter 2 of your book, you began that chapter by quoting Francis Schaeffer, mm-hmm. Where he said, tell me what the world is saying today, and I'll tell you what the church will be saying 7 years from now. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, well, we see that happening. Why else would we have in our mainline denomination such a great divide over, you know, what marriage is and what constitutes sexual sin? That is not a gray area, and yet the culture, again, like I said, has gradually, from generation to generation, relaxed those boundaries, and you know, the enemy has confused and blinded us, and it's just not complicated. We are just meant, as you said, to just focus on a few things, and it all really comes down to the two great commandments: to love God, you know, with all your heart, your mind, your strength, and to love your neighbors yourself. And how can we go wrong if we really, really are doing those things? I have really become a big student lately of the Sermon on the Mount. I love Matthew chapters 5-7. I've really, really looked into those, and there's so much to glean from it. And those are the very words of Christ. People, you know, will say, well, what did Jesus really have to say about this issue? He didn't really say anything about it, did he? Well, actually, he did.
He did indirectly, because he talked about the law, and that was mentioned in the law.
Well, exactly, and he specifically talked about marriage and the purpose of marriage. But he gave us so much in the Sermon on the Mount that if every Christian would just commit themselves to really knowing what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount and say, okay, this is how I'm going to go out and be the church, we would have a totally different impact on the world, on the culture. You know, I love one of the things, since you mentioned chapter 2 in the book, it happens to be on page 53, but I quote a pastor. He's down in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. His name is Tim Holt. And he had just, I just ran across this piece that he wrote in a newspaper, and he said the most wonderful thing, and I loved it, and I quoted in the book here.
I'll tell you what, go ahead and finish it when we get back from this, and
yeah, sure.
One more break. You're listening to the Bob Siegel Show with Debbie Thurman, author of the book Post-Gay, Post-Christian.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's daily blog on townhall.com. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you download past radio shows, Read Bob's many articles about Christianity and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net.
To our program. Debbie, we're down to our last segment, and we'll probably be right in the middle of something when we have to sign off. But let me beforehand, in an unrushed way, thank you so much for taking the time to come on our program. You're a very courageous woman and brilliant woman with a lot to say. I hope everybody will read your book. You were about to quote from a pastor, a quotation that you had in your book.
Right, yeah. This is in the chapter that's, called Ideological Rift with the Church, and he starts out by saying, God doesn't bend his will or ways to accommodate our inclinations. We must, as uncomfortable as it may be, begin to allow ourselves to be lovingly bent toward a posture that reflects God's will. And that's a very difficult thing to do. But he goes down here and he says, bottom line, we cannot, as followers of Jesus, allow ourselves to create theology based on our own desire to accommodate those we care about. And that's a powerful statement. Does that mean we refuse to respect, love, and care for others who fit into this discussion? And he specifically is talking about same-sex attracted people. He says, obviously not. Can we love, serve, and at the same time confront and help one another walk out of our broken areas and into God's will? I certainly hope so. That's the church I love and want to be a part of. And to that I say amen, because that's the church I want to be a part of.
Absolutely. Now, your book, obviously, you said you like reaching out to the prodigal, so obviously that was one of your reasons for writing post-gay, post-Christian. What are some of the other things on your mind? What are you hoping people will glean from this book?
To be honest, the biggest desire of my heart is to really see the church, regardless of where we are, because we're all broken in some way. We're all sinners. We're all broken. We can't allow, at the one extreme, hypocrisy to be a stumbling block for us, because that is the one thing that the gay community will just hone in on with fine-tuned radar. And they're right to do so, and we're wrong to be hypocritical. For example, marriage, the last chapter in the book is about marriage, and this is where we have failed the most. I mean, there are comparisons that are begging to be made, and I do make some of them in the book. Even, bring the discussion about abortion in. But we have failed so badly, and we pretend, this is an elephant in the living room, and we are, we're great. We're the big sleeping giant. We're going to wake up and roar because gay people want to redefine marriage, and they want to be married. Well, isn't it a bit late for that? In fact, I just wrote a little piece on my blog about this week. We need to just realize that we have messed up long before we had the gay rights activists standing up and saying, no, I want you to recognize us too. We want to get married. And we can't deny that. We have to do something. We have to begin mentoring and encouraging and drawing alongside one another as we're struggling and try to realize that we need to get marriage on track. And that's a larger percentage of us who are struggling and who have had, I'm a statistic, I'm a divorcee, and almost once a second time. In fact, statistically, I should not be married, my husband and I should not be married, there's no way, we're way down in the single digits of, that's the percentage of success that we would be given by marriage counselors based on all that we had been through. So we are a miracle. But we have to really stand up and face our shortcomings and realize that we cannot be hypocritical. In the Sermon on the Mount, we're not told that we cannot judge or we cannot make judgments. We cannot be discerning. But we are specifically told by Christ that we're to judge righteously. You take the log out of your own eye before you dare to take the speck out of your brother's.
Yeah, that's right.
And we're not doing that.
Well, and I think the next casualty is not just going to be losing the definition of marriage, but our freedom of speech on this issue, which would prevent us from speaking in a compassionate way or any other way. It's already against the law to say disparaging things about same-sex attraction in Canada, and that kind of agenda is here in America embodied in things such as hate crime legislation, hate speech legislation, etc.
Well, there's, you know, the book is sort of has a twofold message, and of course, it's one thing to speak about the church, what we need to do, and about being compassionate to the struggler, but then you have to draw a line and go over here and look at the whole cultural political.
Well, yeah, because there's always plenty of hypocrisy inside and outside of the church.
Oh yeah. Oh no. There's plenty of hypocrisy on the other side as well. And you know, I very much dislike, and I think everybody's grown very weary of the culture war. But on the other hand, we can't grow weary of the spiritual battle that we face. That's where the real battle is.
That's right.
And we do need to stand up. We need to be able to stand up. Christians need to find their voice, and we do that at the ballot box. But we need to, certainly it needs to be done in pulpits. One of the greatest failings, I think, is our pastors are not preaching culturally relevant and biblically relevant sermons enough.
No, I agree, and I think a lot of pastors, they get scared. These days they're afraid of losing their tax exemptions and things of that nature. And on one hand, we've got to have the courage to stand up for our rights, but on the other hand, our rights are the rights of the gospel, and the gospel is a message of love and forgiveness. And I think sometimes Christians have trouble balancing the two of them.
It's
not that people are saying that we have a fight doesn't mean that we're trying to view people as an enemy. It just means that we have rights, too. If we're living in a democratic society, we also have rights.
Yeah. It's the city of God and the city of man, and we live in both. And that doesn't mean that, you've heard a lot of talk about, you're dominionist. You want to, take over, you Christians, you evangelicals, and you want to rule and have a theocracy and all of this. Well, of course not. That's a lot of trumped up.
Oh, of course.
Nonsense, but
99% of the evangelicals don't believe. There's always a nutcase who does feel that way. But that's for the most part, those are straw men that are being created.
Yeah.
Debbie, how would people get a hold of your book? I assume it's on Amazon.com?
It is, yes.
And is it sold in most bookstores also?
It's certainly available through most bookstores. I don't know how many are stocking, but it's on Amazon.com.
How
they can find
out
more information, certainly by coming to my website. There's links there. I have a
go ahead and give us your website number.
It's debbietherman.com, debbietherman.com.
Okay, and would there be a feature there for people to contact you by email as well?
Yes, and I encourage people to. By all means, I've talked to a great many people on both sides of the issues. It's been a very interesting school that I've attended the last few years.
What kind of reception has your book gotten? What kind of reviews are you getting?
It's really difficult, to get this stone in to make a big enough ripple for me to get a lot of reviews right now. To tell you the truth, it's a very difficult thing. A lot of people are like, okay, that's interesting. What do we do with that? But I've had a very positive reception so far. I mean, I've had very little negative.
Really? So I would have imagined you'd be getting all kinds of hate mail for this, but you're not. That's good to hear.
Yeah, I thought I would be getting a whole lot more hate mail because I've definitely had some interesting conversations in the past. There are people out there who do not like me at all. But, I think that they just are hoping that I and my book will go away.
So they're thinking if we marginalize this rather than making a controversy out of it, that might be the way to go.
Maybe, but I think God may have another idea.
Okay, Debbie, in just a sentence or two, if somebody's listening right now, they're struggling with same-sex attraction, what do you have to say to them?
I say never take hope out of the equation. And there is somebody who cares and who's compassionate. Christ, first of all. But we need Jesus with skin on. There is somebody. And if that somebody has to be me, by all means, reach out and let me know you are there. And I would love to talk to you.
Okay, Debbie, thank you so much. We hope you can come on again sometime. Debbie Thurman, author of Post-Gay, Post-Christian, We'll see you next week.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.